This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association, and always streaming at rightscast.net. MFA, three letters that might inspire some but leave others out in the cold. In an industry already rife with gatekeeping and rejection, it's only natural for one to wonder whether it's worth the process of applying for and completing an MFA of one's own. This episode's guest, however, has put three more letters before MFA, and she's using them to challenge the status quo when it comes to one's writerly education. Hey there, I'm author, writing coach, and RightsCast Network founder, R.R. Campbell, and this is episode 81 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association. For this episode, I'm joined by Gabriella Pereira of DIY MFA. Gabriella is a writer, teacher, and self-proclaimed word nerd who wants to challenge the status quo of higher education. As the founder and instigator of DIYMFA.com, her mission is to empower writers to take an entrepreneurial approach to their education and professional growth. Over the course of our conversation, we'll discuss Gabriella's challenge to the status quo and how you, our listeners, can get involved with a DIY MFA of your own. Stay tuned after the episode to learn more about what you can expect next on the RightsCast Network, and thanks, as always, for listening. Thank you so much, Gabriella Pereira, for joining me here on the R.R. Campbell RightsCast on the RightsCast Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited to be here.
And I'm really excited to be interviewing you. I had a chance to tune in to your podcast actually today for the first time. You brought a lot of energy to that particular episode. So I'm already feeling we're going to have good energy for this episode here today. So let's kick it off right away. We're talking about the DIY MFA today, but for listeners who might be tuning in and actually don't have familiarity with the good old MFA, Gabriella, can you explain what a traditional MFA is?
Sure. So an MFA, it stands for Master of Fine Arts, and it's the degree that you would get if you were to do graduate studies in any type of art. So theater, music, studio art, and of course, creative writing. So the MFA generally consists of between 2 or 3 years of study. In those 2 to 3 years, depending on the program, you usually have a workshop component every semester. You also have literature courses that you take. Depending on the school, they may have other requirements like craft workshops or attending readings and basically like literary citizenship, you know, being a good literary citizen. The program that I attended, I was in the Writing for Children division. So instead of majors, they have like divisions of writing. So the school I attended had poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, and then writing for children. And so I took a lot of workshops, literature classes, both in children's literature and also in other literature. Like they wanted us to branch out and study other things, which was kind of fun. And then usually in your last semester, you do what they call the thesis, which is basically you write your book, or at least some portion that will become your book eventually. I worked on a manuscript that I eventually completed, but ended up never pursuing because DIY MFA kind of gripped me by the throat and didn't let go. So there you have it.
So, and speaking of this DIY MFA, this is of course something that stemmed, if I'm understanding correctly, as a result of your desire to challenge the status quo in higher education, or namely in this case, the traditional MFA. And Gabriella, what is it that made you want to challenge that status quo?
Well, it's interesting. Like I talk about challenging the status quo of education, but it's really not about getting all down on the MFA itself. When I started DIY MFA, I started it because I loved my MFA program and I didn't want it to end. But there was this pesky thing called graduation. So I was, you know, going to get shoved out of the nest whether I liked it or not. And I realized as I was sort of facing graduation and dealing with that, that a lot of the things that I did as an MFA student, I had already been doing to some degree at some point in my life. For example, I had a writing group that we would meet every couple of weeks and we'd workshop each other's stories. That was a lot like the MFA workshop that I was part of as a student. I read a lot of books. I was constantly reading and analyzing what I read, which is kind of like what I did in the literature courses at the MFA. And, you know, I went to conferences, I went to readings, I went to workshops. So I was doing all those things already. And I realized that even though I had a great experience, a lot of that stuff was already part of my life. Like I didn't really need the MFA in order to have that structure. So what ended up happening was I realized also at sort of simultaneously as I was not wanting to let go of my MFA experience, I also realized that there were a lot of people in the world who wanted that MFA experience and couldn't do it. I recognize that even now, I probably wouldn't be able to do a traditional MFA. I'm not in a place in my life where that would be feasible or reasonable. I was in a very privileged position back when I attended the MFA program. My husband had a fancy law firm job. I could afford to take a few years off of work in order to really throw myself into my writing. We didn't have kids at the time. So a lot of those logistical things that would have gotten in the way of going to a traditional program weren't factors for us back then, but they are definitely factors for me now with two kids, running a full-time job, all of those things. So I realized there were a lot of people out there who wanted this experience. And I knew this because I talked to them. I asked them. These were like my friends from writing conferences or other places where I would meet fellow writers. And they wanted this experience, but they couldn't get it because they couldn't put their lives on hold just so that they could go back to school. So I started thinking, well, okay, how can I recreate this experience both so that I can continue my MFA experience forever and also so that I can share it with other people who might not have the ability to go to a traditional program? And so that's how DIY MFA was born. That's sort of how we challenged it. It wasn't really about like MFA, traditional MFA versus us, like an us versus them thing. It was more about how can we fill a need that is not being filled.
And it sounds like you are certainly accomplishing that with your vision for DIY MFA. You mentioned, for example, what it is that an MFA generally tends to consist of, and also how you were, interestingly enough, already doing some of that in your own life. And so I have to imagine then that that is, of course, where the DIY or the do-it-yourself for the folks out there who may not be so acronym proficient, that's where the DIY comes into play here. And you've mentioned this a little bit in your previous response as well about how your life changed. What I want to know is, what is the general profile of someone or of a writer who might consider participating in one of these DIY MFA structures?
So the way I like to think about our word nerds, which is what I call our audience, our readers, our peeps, is I think of them sort of with two different like categorizations. One of them is experience level, and the other one is how much time do they have on their hands. So, and it's weird because a lot of times when people think of like, you need to analyze your audience, you know, like when we're told as writers, like you need to understand who your readers are, the first thing we think about are demographics, like women, age, this to that, or whatever. But really the demographics or the psychographics actually that I've found that really resonate and that help me understand who the word nerds are so we can better serve them are things that are much more focused on their behaviors. So we found that there are basically three different levels of intensity experience in our word nerd audience. There are the newbie writers, They're the writers in the trenches. These are the folks, the newbies are the folks who are just getting started. They have an idea that they want to write a book, but they are not really sure what to do next. They want to write, they just don't know how to start. Then we have the writers in the trenches. These are usually writers who are deep in the trenches working on a project. It might be their first project, it might be their 12th project, but they're in the middle of working on a project. And then, of course, there are the writers who have now moved into like the career writing phase. These are folks who have now published at least one book. They are no longer thinking in terms of when I get or if I get published. They are now thinking in terms of when my next book gets published. So it's become part of their career to be publishing books. And the reason it's important to think about these different stages is that writers at these different places in their careers are going to have different needs. Most of the time, once somebody is in that pro zone, they don't really need DIY MFA anymore. They're pretty much on track. They kind of know what they need to do. That said, they may need more support in terms of how they're going to build their careers, how they're going to build their platforms, which is why at DIY MFA, we actually built a course for our more advanced writers, specifically because we realized that there wasn't anything for them and we wanted to serve that need. The majority of our courses or of our audience, they are the ones in the trenches. Like that is the vast majority of DIY MFA word nerds. And so you'll notice that a lot of the material we create, a lot of the stuff we share on our website and the podcast, it's always focused on the craft because when you're in the trenches writing your book, the craft is what's important. That said, our audience has shifted. In the beginning, it was like 90% or 80% in the trenches writers. Now I'd say it's more like 50%-ish. And a big chunk of that shift has moved in the newbie direction. So what does that mean? It means that there are now people who are discovering DIY MFA earlier in their trajectory, in their careers, in their writing journeys. And so these folks are going to have very different concerns, very different needs than someone who's deep in the trenches of writing a book. These are the folks who need more of the motivational support, helping them generate ideas, helping them start and finish smaller projects that are, you know, more manageable than, say, embarking on an entire epic series. So thinking of our audience in these terms has helped us to also serve them in the way that is best for each individual group. On the other side, each of these groups also breaks down into two possible categories. So like if you think of it, it's like a 3x2 matrix.
Yes, I've been drawing it out on my notepad here.
So like the two other categories that overlap with each of these three like stages in the writing journey are whether they have time on their hands or whether they don't. So people usually fall into one of these buckets. Either they're trying to fit their writing around a very, very busy life that is already very busy, or they're coming to writing after some pocket of time has now opened up. So the second group, by the way, is probably a little bit smaller, but we do notice a lot of folks who find DIY MFA when they're either just retired or on their way to retiring. And so they want to start getting into the writing habit because that's what they want to do with their next chapter. They want to write books. Also, we see a lot of like moms whose youngest kid just went to kindergarten and suddenly they're like, well, not right now because we're in the middle of the whole COVID thing, but like, you know, under normal circumstances, your youngest kid goes to kindergarten, suddenly you have like all this time on your hands and you're like, what do I do with myself? So, you know, there are folks like that who suddenly have some space in their life open up, like empty nesters or their kid just went to school or, you know, they just retired or they finally been able to like quit their job and do what they wanted to do with their life. Like whatever reason they may have for having more time to write, they have more space. So like the folks who are fitting their writing in the nooks and crannies of their life, they're going to have very different needs than the folks who suddenly have the time to fill, but now they need to structure it so they actually make it productive. Both of those things, by the way, can be really challenging. It's just as challenging to have a long swath of writing time but not know what to do with it than it is to have really small pockets of writing time and need to fit your writing around a lot of other stuff.
I can say 100% that that has been my experience as someone who was for a long time one of the people that had minimal availability and was just trying to squeeze in the writing where I could. Well, I always thought someday I'll have so much time to write. I'll carve out all this time and I'll write for 4 hours a day. Well, a couple of years ago, I made the transition to going to just work part-time and I freed up 20 plus additional hours a week to write. And guess what I do in that time? Well, I still do about the same amount of writing. I just do a lot more podcasting. So it's amazing how that shifts, right? It's here at long last. It is here. We're talking about the Wisconsin Writers Association's 72nd annual Jade Ring Writing Contest. Yes, as of this episode's air date, the submission window is open and the people of the Wisconsin Writers Association are looking for your poetry, for your nonfiction, and for your fiction to be submitted into this year's Jade Ring. First place entries in all of those categories will be published in Wisconsin People and Ideas magazine, as well as Creative Wisconsin Literary Journal, and there are also cash prizes in play and the coveted Jade Ring itself. So to learn more and to make sure you get your entry in before the window closes, visit wiwrite.org/contests today. That's wiwrite.org/contests.
It is. And, you know, there's an economics law called Parkinson's law, that the idea is that your a task will expand or contract in order to fill the amount of space allotted for that task. The same thing is true for a budget, like an expense will expand or contract depending on how much space you have in that budget. And so it's kind of amazing that, like, when we have more space, we actually become less efficient with our time than if we have a more contracted period of time. This is actually one of the reasons why when I need to get something done, I always schedule it right before I have a hard stop time at the end. Like, I have a meeting or a podcast recording or something that I will have to drop everything and go, because it forces me to, like, use Parkinson's law to its best effect. Like, I have to keep whatever work I do, whatever writing I do, within that pocket of time. So I make the best use of it as I possibly can.
And now there is a pro tip. I really do appreciate that, because what I have found is that to make sure I'm still doing my writing, I have time set aside for it in the morning, but I used to be really good about picking it up in the afternoon. But without structured time and without a little bit of a deadline there to kind of make me take advantage of this law in the same way that you do, well, that afternoon writing time has fallen to the wayside and it's gone into all of this other platform-oriented business, which of course I love, but it's not the same as words on the page. So a great tip there from you, Gabriella, and I hope that that is something listeners can take with them as we advance through this conversation. I did want to say, though, that I really appreciate what you were saying earlier about how the profile of the individuals who participate in a DIY MFA or who are part of the audience, it's really diverse. It seems like it is something that is made to be accessible to individuals and really meet them where they are at so that they can have a sort of versatile experience. They can sort of do, maybe they're not able normally to do a residency program or even a part-time residency program because, well, guess what? They're doing that residency from the comfort of their own home, right? So I really do appreciate that. And I think that is one of the many advantages that we might see to a DIY MFA over that sort of more traditional structure.
Absolutely. And I think that everybody wins when you have more diversity in a community. One of the things I love is how different every cohort of students that we have, how different it is. Not just in terms of, like, you know, ethnicity or racial diversity or socioeconomic diversity. And part of the reason we price our courses the way we do is because we both want to honor the value in them, but we also want to make them as accessible as we possibly can. So we really are very careful in making sure that we make it as accessible as possible. And also just like one of the things that always blows my mind is the age range. Like we've got folks literally just like college students who are doing DIY MFA like while they're still finishing their college studies, all the way to folks in like their 80s. And that is amazing to me. I think it's so incredible. And there's a wealth of knowledge that each person brings to the table, a wealth of experiences, a wealth of just life that is, I think it helps to amplify the experience for everybody in the group. So to me, that's just like, it's one of my favorite parts of DIY MFA.
Just like there are so many stories that we have to tell in, say, the realm of fiction, there really are so many stories that need to be told in the nonfiction of our lives as well. And that's something that I have really come into understand better through the RightsCast Network's new Profiles in Encouragement series, which kind of stemmed from this whole, well, feels like the world is standing still right now. What can we do to support each other? I've been encouraging people to call into the show. I've been encouraging them to send voice memos to my email inbox and share their words of encouragement, their inspiration, their story to being a writer. And just like you say, Gabriella, it is so inspiring to know that there are people of all different ages, of all different backgrounds. They're coming to the world of writing from many unique places in their lives and with a great set of different experiences behind them. And they really do make up this fantastic tapestry of not necessarily the hashtag writing community that we see just sometimes online, but what is truly a global experience, a global writing community. And DIY MFA gives people the opportunity to really tap into that, it seems. And that's something that, as I am continuing to learn and be impressed by every day here on the RightsCast Network, it's really great to be a part of that in whatever capacity we can.
Absolutely. And there's also another level of diversity that comes into play too, and that's diversity in what we write. And, you know, I find that a lot of genres tend to get siloed. This is especially true the more I've been like exposed to how publishing operates, how you might have like a big publisher and different imprints within the same publisher, basically just like their own little pockets, and they don't communicate with each other. They don't know what books are coming out in the other imprints. It's kind of astonishing to me. And, you know, it also to me was really amazing when I was in the traditional MFA that, so I was in Writing for Children, which was kind of like, we were like the renegade group because we were writing books for kids, but that also meant that like we wrote fantasy and we wrote sci-fi and we had someone writing graphic novels and we had all sorts of like really cool genre-y, but also beautifully written stuff coming out from our cohort. And a lot of the other divisions, like poetry and fiction, I remember in our graduation readings, a lot of their stuff sounded the same. Hmm. And, you know, there's often people joke about how you go to a traditional program and a lot of the voices that come out of MFAs start to sound the same because they're taking the same classes and they're hanging out with the same people. And there's sort of that echo chamber effect that ends up happening. And one of the things I love with DIY MFA, also with when I had that critique group that I met with, is we were always every single genre, like we were genre agnostic. We accepted everybody. And part of that is because you learn so much from people writing things that are different from you. It's a lot harder to learn from people who are writing things that are exactly the same as what you're writing. Like you're much more likely to be challenged and to be pushed beyond your comfort zone if you are reading and critiquing and also discussing literature with people who are coming at it from a different perspective in terms of genre. Like if I need someone to help me fix the plot of a story, hands down, I'm going to go to a thriller writer because they know how to plot a story, or a mystery writer because they know how to like set up all those little dominoes. Romance writers are amazing at character development. Historical fiction authors are amazing at world building. Like there's so many different things that different genres bring to the table. And I think often that gets lost in the shuffle because people want to be with their own kind. They want to be with their birds of a feather, and there isn't as much crossover.
I would certainly agree with that. I have had my own experience with several different critique groups over the years, and oftentimes I have found myself having to step away due to things like time, but also because I find myself going, hey, I think we might all be encouraging each other to develop and stick with this sort of quote unquote house style. And over time, you start to realize, well, is that really the kind of writer that I want to be? I certainly grew and I understood more about tension and plot and the things that those particular groups were great at. But at the same time, I don't know if that was exactly how I wanted to write. And it's taken me several years to kind of come back to finding and embracing my voice while also embracing the more mechanical aspects that I was learning by participating in groups like that.
Absolutely.
And we've been talking now about the writing, which I think is great. That is, of course, what writing is all about. You got to have some words somewhere, right? But the central tenets of DIY MFA seem to be writing, reading, and community. And let's maybe drill down here really on the writing aspect of it. What is the philosophy, if there is one, to getting folks to the page and encouraging them to do their best work? Whatever the case might be, Gabriella, if you can elaborate on that, that would be fantastic.
Absolutely. So I can just hop on my soapbox now because I love talking about this stuff. Okay. So DIY MFA breaks down into three pillars: write with focus, read with purpose, and build your community. Once upon a time, we didn't have neat little triad of pillars. We had like a bajillion pillars. It took a long time of like refining and working through the structure of the DIY MFA curriculum to figure out like what our methodology really was. But eventually we narrowed it down to writing with focus as being the writing piece of the puzzle. Now, I think of writing as any sort of creative output. So it may not necessarily be writing things on a piece of paper. It could be producing, like talking into an audio recorder. It could be writing blog posts, if that is part of what it is that you do to create your body of work. So like a lot of times people are very relentless in saying like, if it's not going to be in the book, it's not real writing. And well, that's sort of true. Like I think you could go down the rabbit hole of writing character dossiers to death and never actually finish a book. But I think we also need to acknowledge that there's a lot of other writing that happens around our book writing that is just as important and that needs space in your writing schedule. When it comes to writing with focus, it involves a couple of things. It involves the creativity aspect, like actually developing ideas and seeing them through to the finish line, learning how to manage your time and manage your productivity so that you are more effective and efficient with the time that you have. So these are all sort of ancillary things. And then there's the actual craft of writing, understanding the craft and mastering the craft. That is probably my favorite part of DIY MFA and of the curriculum. It's where I pour my heart and soul because I just love geeking out over the craft of writing. But writing also includes other things like getting feedback on your work, like getting, critiques and whatnot. Like that kind of crosses, it's sort of in that gray area between writing and community, right? One of the core tenets at DIY MFA, one of the core philosophies is that I am a firm believer in being proactive with your writing skills as opposed to being reactive with them, which is one of the reasons why at DIY MFA, we often will lump critique with the community part. And it's often added on later in the educational process than a lot of traditional MFAs do. In most traditional MFAs, that is the bulk of your writing work, is what you write for your workshop. And then you basically bring in your pages and people rip them apart. And while that is certainly valuable to get feedback on your writing, you have to recognize that when you're getting feedback, you are learning by writing something and then having someone say, that's wrong or that's not good enough. And then you fix it. So it's a retroactive way of learning as opposed to a proactive way of learning. At DIY MFA, we're much more interested in helping people build good habits to begin with. So instead of having you learn to do things one way and then have to like upend your process because it turns out it's no good, it doesn't work, we'd much rather have you build your skills and practice. We talk about micro practicing, like taking one tiny skill that you need to do in a book, whether it's a transition from one time to another time, and try to brainstorm like how many different ways can you get your character from morning until the next day without saying the next day? How can you create that gap without having to write 30 pages? And sort of working out these like niceties of the craft in little tiny pieces. And then when you sit down to write your book, you actually have the skills. So like it'll come out naturally. It won't be stilted. It won't be like mechanical. So I'm a firm believer with the writing component, really diving into the craft. This is why at DIY MFA, a lot of times we'll practice, like it's a lot of technical practice. Like in our courses, I'll give people actual homework assignments. Like I want you to write the scene four different ways. Here are the four different ways that you're going to write it. And then you tell us which one you like the best. That gives people a much more proactive approach to their writing. And it also gives the writer more agency, right? Because it's not up to someone else to tell you what you did wrong. It's up to you to try to experiment with different choices and then decide what you like better.
Well, I am recording this ad in the early afternoon, which means I am suffering from that post-lunch lull, and right about now I am wishing I had not gone through my 421 Brewhouse coffee so quickly. I really do miss it. I like that mountain mist. You've heard me talk about it in past episodes before. 421 Brewhouse has those really cool, reusable, resealable bags. I've still got that bag laying around, but it's empty and it's making me sad. I need to find a way to keep using it. Sustainability is really important to 421 Brewhouse, and it's really important to us here at the RightsCast Network as well. But you know what else is really important? That coffee. And I really need to place another order, and I hope that you'll consider placing an order with 421 Brewhouse as well. You can visit their Shopify page and get in on some of their awesome blends like Mountain Mist, Amazon Haze, Sahara Sunrise, Arctic Snow, which is their decaf. They do make a decaf available for you as well. So please seek out 421 Brewhouse. Go ahead and use coupon code RightsCast at checkout. You'll get yourself a nice little discount, and that'll help the RightsCast Network out as well. And then, you know, you won't be like me, missing your coffee in the early afternoon. So again, that's 421 Brewhouse. Those are the numbers, 421 followed by Brewhouse. Go ahead and get yourself a bag today with coupon code RightsCast. And there really is something to be said for having to go through the steps of a discovery process to develop a true understanding of mechanics that might otherwise be thrust upon someone retroactively or reactively rather than proactively. There are so many writers that I have seen sit down and go, okay, I have time to write my book, but they aren't familiar with something like DIY MFA. They don't know what resources are out there. They sit down and they write and they write and they write. And then someday someone says to them a phrase like, well, you know, you need to show, not tell. Okay, cool. But what does that really mean if you've just put in all of this work? Whereas if you are challenged in advance and perhaps not presented with it in maybe such a prescriptive way, but it's presented as an exercise or just a fun assignment, a different opportunity to rewrite the same scene, people can kind of come into an understanding of that on their own. And I think that that is a really interesting approach and something that I wish I saw more people able to embody out there.
Yeah, I'm a total like skills and technique geek. So like for me, this is like kid in a candy store.
Right. And that's great, because what I love too is that at the RightsCast Network here, we are of course all about talking craft, but we're also about talking these sort of ancillary things like making time to write, or even you mentioned having this one tiny skill that you're going to have someone focus on. Well, we did a whole episode on that probably a couple of years ago by now. That was the Training Your Writing Dragon episode for people who might be familiar with that one. That was a lot of fun. So it's really neat to see that everyone's out there trying to see what works, and it seems like you are bringing it all under a nice umbrella here in this one, or should we say this pillar or this column, one of the three that you have for DIY MFA, where the writing is concerned. You mentioned earlier, though, that with a traditional MFA, you have a reading list as well, where maybe your professors or the instructors that are involved, they're going to let you know, this is what you need to be reading. This is an important part of your pathway to getting your MFA. Well, reading is also a big component to a DIY MFA, but my understanding is that your approach to this reading component is a little bit different.
Yeah, so I'm not good at dealing with authority, like, at all. So when people say, like, you have to read this, I will totally not read it because
understood. Yes. Yep.
And so with DIY MFA, when I was trying to figure out, like, I knew reading had to be a big part of the puzzle. And in most MFA programs, and the reason I say most is, like, I've looked at, when I was developing DIY MFA, I didn't just look to the program I had recently graduated. I also researched a lot of other programs. And, you know, if you look at their, what their application process is, and you look at, like, they'll say what their curriculum is and what the required courses are. And from that, I was able to glean what the breakdown was in terms of, like, how big of a part the workshop took or the reading, you know, literature courses took, et cetera. And one of the things that kind of drove me nuts at the MFA program is, while I had some really wonderful literature classes, like, don't get me wrong, I think I probably took all the best ones. I was super lucky. I got into all the best ones. But it just drove me nuts to have to read books that someone else was telling me to read. And I remember I was taking this one literature class on the vernacular. And this professor became, like, my absolute favorite professor after that. He basically walks in on the first day of class. First off, he walks in, he puts a bottle of wine in the middle of the table. And so I'm like, all right, dude, like, word. Yeah, I get you. You're my kind of professor. And then he's like, look, some of the stuff you're going to read is really, really, really boring. And I get it. So if you can make a compelling argument for why you couldn't get past a certain point in the book, I will listen to the argument and I will give you a free pass on that book. Let me tell you, I took him up on that multiple times. But to me, that was really interesting that he took that approach, because he was respecting us enough to A, respect our time and respect that, like, we weren't just going to read these books that weren't resonating with us just because the teacher told us to. And B, he was making us think about why we didn't want to read it. So that actually was, in some ways, a more educationally beneficial, like, a useful exercise than if he had just said, eh, whatever, you don't, like, these books are all boring, let's scrap them from the list. Or if he had said, like, you know, you have to read them, suck it up and read them anyway. So he was, that kind of got me thinking. And I was like, well, what if people were empowered to choose their own reading lists? Like, we're not dummies. We're grownups here. Like, anyone from college and beyond, like, college age and beyond, probably even high schoolers, are smart enough to be able to pick what books they want to read and put together their own reasonable reading list. If I'm left to my own devices, the stuff I would have picked probably would have been as challenging or more than the stuff that this professor was making us read. But it would have been stuff I wanted to read. It would have been stuff that resonated with me. So that is where I started thinking about, like, the mechanics of putting such a reading curriculum syllabus together. And so I started thinking, well, what kinds of books would one need to read as a writer? And I also was thinking in terms of, like, how could I make this streamlined so that another person could follow the same steps as me, but develop a very different list that's totally catered to them? So I came up with the four C's. The first C is comps, comparable books. These are books that are similar to the book that you are working on or whatever project you're working on, you know, the competitive books or whatever. The second C is for contextual. So anything that you might read to lend context to your book. So it could be research. It could be a book that is similar in terms of theme, but maybe it falls in a different genre. Anything that could help inform the book that you're writing, but it isn't an indirect competition to the book you're writing. The third C is contemporary, because let's face it, it's really easy, at least for me, to, like, spend all my time reading the really, really old stuff. Like, in college when I have an English major, and I never wanted to read 20th century stuff. It was all, like, 15th, 16th, 17th century stuff. And, like, there was a one semester requirement of 20th century literature, and that was, like, painful for me. But anyway, I survived. But, like, you know, I've realized, like, contemporary books are kind of important, especially in some genres when trends change really quickly. Like, if you look, for instance, at the category YA, right, young adult, that category has really only existed as its own thing and not as an offshoot of children's books. or adults books since like the 60s. So that's a very small span of time for a category of literature to exist, which means that anything from like the 90s or the early 2000s are now going to be considered classics. They're not current anymore because they're already like 20 years old or 30 years old. So like within the context of the existence of this type of literature. So you have to think about like, okay, these all these books that people think of as being like the, you know, like Speak from Laurie Hall Sanderson, you know, quintessential YA book. It's not a contemporary book anymore by any stretch. Like that book is a classic. So what are the current books that are out right now? And I like to consider contemporary anything that's been published within the last 2 to 3 years tops, because current needs to be really current. Right. And then of course you have the classics. So like the classics could be, you know, Shakespeare. They could also be, you know, YA novels from the 90s. So it kind of runs the gamut what you want to consider a classic relative to your own book. But the whole idea with this rubric, these four C's, is that it gives you a structure on how to select the books you want to choose, but it also forces you to position them in accordance to what you're working on. So it's not just reading for reading's sake, it's reading to help you write a better book.
And it really is also a one hand feeds the other feeds the next, because you talk about, for example, comp titles, and we also talk about contemporary titles. And one thing that I see or I hear all of the time is that when it comes time to seek representation for authors who are trying to go the agented or the traditional route, they'll have these comparison titles in their query letters that are maybe decades old, that are maybe classics, for example. Mm-hmm. And okay, great. You might have studied up really intensely on those classics, right? But if you aren't writing in the context of the current market, or if at least you don't understand how quickly the market can change, giving agents an opportunity to understand where your book fits in that contemporary, that third C, and also ties in then, of course, to our comp titles. And we, of course, did it all with context in mind while having studied the classics. And so it's all very interrelated, it seems, and it's important that you've made those distinctions, I would say.
And sometimes it also, like, it'll catch you by surprise. So one of the projects that I wrote, this was even before the MFA program, I was working on a middle grade novel that was basically a retelling of Homer's Odyssey. And I read Homer's Odyssey. I read multiple translations, and I read the Aeneid in Latin because, you know, I did Latin in college and I'm a nerd. And I read all these books that were like sort of ancillary to this project. And I remember at one point kind of stressing out because there was a scene that I wanted to include that involved the Trojan horse. But it turns out the Trojan horse, like that happens during the battle, right? So I'm thinking like, this isn't going to work. And then I went to the text in the Odyssey and I realized like, no, the Trojan horse never actually appears in the Iliad ever. It only happens as a backstory, like as a flashback part in the Odyssey. So of course it works to have this in this particular. So like sometimes your lizard brain, you read enough of this stuff and your lizard brain figures it out before your actual brain does.
And we can't really be getting that lizard brain trained up unless we're doing that reading, unless we're letting it stew, we're distilling it kind of over time. It doesn't need to be that sort of immediate engagement. I need to, you know, take a nice big bite out of this book and immediately be breaking it down. No, we're just reading with purpose, as you say. And sometimes it takes us a while to find that purpose. But if we are deliberate in the selection of the titles that we choose to attack, well, eventually, hey, it looks like it can all come back to us here.
Absolutely. I also highly recommend reading short form work, especially if you're someone like me and you don't always have an attention span that allows you to finish a book. It's very hard for me with the podcast because I'm constantly reading whatever the book is of the people that we have on DIY MFA radio. So like I have like 30 books going at any given moment. And so reading short fiction or short essays or poetry is also incredibly useful because what it does is it allows you to see the beginning, middle, and end of a complete story in one sitting, which no matter how fast you read a novel, by the time you get to like the 300th whatever page, your brain isn't going to be fully present to what was on page one anymore. So like reading a short story or an essay allows you to sort of contain the whole thing in your brain, which is a very different experience from a reading perspective, because it allows you to have both the macro level of analysis going on in your brain, but then also the micro level, looking at, you know, the niceties, the details, all those small things.
This episode of the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast is brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing. Dandelion Web Marketing helps writers everywhere build a thriving author platform through strategic web marketing. If you're not sure if you're on the right track with your website, if the entire thing just seems like a boondoggle, or you can't quite get the traffic that you're looking for on this critical part of your author platform, well, Dandelion Web Marketing can help with that. And how do they help? Well, they help with one of their author website audits. Right now, listeners to the WritesCast Network can receive 50% off. That's 50% off one of these author website audits. And that audit is going to look at your site's content, its security, design, search engine optimization, and more. And along the way, it will provide you with insight into what you might do to improve your connection with your audience. To learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and save 50% along the way, you can visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast. That's really a great point about short fiction, because I think that this is another thing where we see some siloization within the writing community. You know, you have, of course, your writers and they're in their particular genre camps, but you also have this, well, I write novels or I write short fiction, and I can say I'm just as guilty of it as the next person. I tend to sit down and really focus on my novels, and I only take time for short fiction, either as a writer or as a reader, maybe once every couple of years. And frankly, I think, as you've said here, I know I personally would really stand to benefit from engaging more with short form fiction. Maybe I just need to find the community to push it on me a little bit more, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
And on that point then too, of course, we've talked about the writing, we've talked about the reading. Community is this third pillar for DIY MFA. So we are, of course, big on community at the WritesCast Network. How does community figure into DIY MFA?
So there are basically three types of community that any writer has. There's the community with your fellow writers, there's community with your readers, and then there's community with the literary community at large, or the publishing industry. So I like to think of these as separate, like, pockets within the community element, because the way you navigate each one is going to be a little bit different. So for example, the community with your fellow writers, that's going to be the type of community where you're trying to get, you know, feedback on your writing, forming a critique group, getting beta readers. The give and take is really important in this part of, in this type of community. Having an equilibrium is really important. You don't want to be the person who takes, and all of a sudden you get booted from your critique group because you never offer critique to anybody else. It happens. Trust me. So like, there's definitely that element where, you know, you need a little bit more of a balance when you're in sort of the community with your peers. When you're building community with your readers, the expectation is that you will be producing work. They will be reading your work. Maybe they'll reach back out to you, but you can't count on that. And so it is definitely a much more, like, it's a broad thoroughfare from writer to reader and a much narrower pathway from reader back to writer. So you don't get as much feedback, unless oftentimes it's the more impassioned feedback is what you get. People are much more likely to reach out and let writers know what they think of their books if they're either in love with the book or if they absolutely hate it and think it's the worst thing ever. You don't get like a lot of the, you know, yeah, it was kind of okay feedback on your work. Like, people don't bother to take the time to give that kind of feedback. So it's definitely a different dynamic, right? Like, feedback with your readers. I've found that with DIY MFA, creating a community within our readership has been really huge. Enlisting our readers to be part of the team, as it were. Like when the DIY MFA book came out, I created a street team and I got our readers, a group of readers. They actually had to apply to join. It was not just a random anybody can join kind of thing. And so there was definitely that feeling of specialness, right? That it was like a special thing that people got to be part of. And they got an advanced copy of the book. And then we did all sorts of like guided reading things where I got a chance to get their feedback on different ideas of, you know, worksheets I wanted to create or other, you know, prompts and things like that. So it was really useful. I learned a lot from it. I got a ton of feedback from the readers. They also had a blast doing it. So it kind of worked. It was sort of a, you know, what's the word? Like there was a synergy to it, but it definitely is a different dynamic than had that group been, say, people who are my peers. In terms of like their, you know, fellow writers, et cetera. And then of course there's like the community with the publishing industry or the literary community at large. And there, again, it's like if often for writers, it can feel like an imbalance. Like it can feel like agents and editors are up on this pedestal and we're kind of like scrounging for the scraps at the table, which is a horrible feeling, and it's so not true, but it's really hard sometimes not to allow ourselves to buy into that thinking when we hear stories about how many times people get rejected before their book finally finds a home and all of that stuff. So it's really hard to stay the course and to, you know, let yourself really feel that, yes, I do have a seat at the table and whatnot. I remember for me, like, it took a long time to recognize that, like, wait, I should be here. It's okay that I'm here. That took a while.
And I really like this idea of dividing the idea or partitioning the idea of community into these three unique lanes. Because one thing that I found as an author is that when it came time for my first books to come out, they came out in rapid succession. There wasn't a lot of opportunity to learn from my previous mistakes. So what I did is, well, I relied on my community. I relied on my platform. But as it turned out, the community that I had been cultivating was very writer specific. It wasn't necessarily open to readers or people who would normally read the kind of fiction that I was producing. And so I had to and continue to be on this sort of long journey to figuring out who my ideal reader or who my readers are or would be. And, you know, that's tough to do when the book's already been out for a while because, well, you were hoping on readers recommending it to readers, but you were marketing to writers all along. And so it's good to have that idea in mind as we try to be proactive again, rather than perhaps reactive.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I think a lot of people, it's easier to talk to other writers, right? Because other writers, like, they get it. Like, we're all wizards, word wizards living in a muggle world. So it's easier to talk to other word wizards, right? But what we often, and often we'll think, well, we'll often think to ourselves, like, well, writers like to read. So of course it makes sense that we talk to other writers. What we forget is that of the population of readers in the world, only a teeny tiny little group are actually writers. Yep. So we're basically excluding this much bigger population of people who would also be really interested in our books because we just don't want to, you know, like we're not taking the time to reach beyond our word wizard circles. You know, the other thing too is like having these three lanes also allows you to modulate how you present yourself. So like the way I present myself to my readers is going to be very different than say the way I might present myself to like when I'm navigating a book expo kind of event that is much more sort of business oriented. And so it's just a question, it's not that like I'm acting fake or I'm like being different, but it's that you modulate. Like your personality is still the same, but you modulate it slightly so that you're speaking and communicating with the right language for the audience that you're communicating with.
And I think that's a really important point to drive home is because you hear so much about, well, if you're just authentic, you'll find your people, right? And I think that that is one of those bits of advice.
When people talk about being authentic online, like seriously, it's like, really, guys, like we're all somehow modulating our personas. You don't want to see the hot mess that was running through my house 20 minutes ago. Like, come on.
Right. And it's something that is one of those bits of advice that I think comes from a really good place, because it's encouraging us to embrace, you know, who we really are and not feel like, okay, well, I must only be like this particular, whatever vision you have in your head of what a writer is supposed to be, right? But as again, I have learned in the aftermath of several book launches that had good initial success, but then it all kind of dropped off. Well, it's because I wasn't embracing this idea of modulation. I was just putting up that very professional front everywhere. And it hasn't been until the last several months where I've returned to kind of writing in a style that feels more true to me, where I've started a new podcast where it is just not about sitting here and being professional about writing, kind of like we're doing in this environment, but really just letting the wheels spin and trying to embrace this other, more modulated version of me that I'm hoping eventually might connect with readers. And if it doesn't, you know, at the same time, it's still an opportunity for me to try and engage with whoever might be tuning into that particular podcast. So there we have it again. We want to be aware of this partition because there are opportunities to then better understand it and embrace it as we see fit, rather than relying on that sort of stock, well, just be authentic advice, because, well, Gabriella, you've made your feelings very clear about it, and I'm starting to learn that it's much more complicated than I would have expected as well.
You know, it's interesting too. I get up on my soapbox about this stuff a lot. First off, I think that it's kind of inauthentic to say, just be authentic, because it's kind of like a shortcut that doesn't mean anything. The other thing too is, at the end of the day, we all are experimenting and modulating and trying to figure out how we're going to present ourselves as authors, right? We're all figuring out what that infamous author brand, or as I like to call it, author identity, how that's going to take shape. Nobody comes out of their womb with their author brand already figured out. Like,
sure,
even Oprah started somewhere. Like, even she started from zero, right? And I think one of the things that people often forget is that we have this amazing opportunity at the very beginnings of our careers where nobody's watching us. So we can do whatever we want. We can try all the wild and crazy things. And if it blows up in our face, like, there's only a few dozen people watching, and that's okay. And most of those people, like, you know, spoiler alert, at the beginning, most of the people who follow your career are going to be people who like you as a person. Like, they know you. They're going to be like your friends who happen to also follow you on social media. So it's one of those things that I think we're always in such a hurry to get big, to get to that point where we have a platform. And I really regret not taking more time when I first started to enjoy what I like to call the zero moment, that moment where nobody's really watching you, when you're lying under the radar, when you get to be a hot mess and no one really cares because there's only like three people who watch and one of them's your mother. You're like, you know, it's okay to mess up in that context. Now it's not so much. Like, now my word nerds are going to notice if I, you know, do something completely whacked out. So it's not that it's one is better than the other, but I think that it's often a missed opportunity that we're usually pushing ourselves to grow so fast that we forget to enjoy the beginning where we are. And once we grow, we can never go back to that state.
A lot of really great lessons there. I know that we scooted a little bit away from DIY MFA itself, but I'm really grateful that you were able to share that with us, because those are all the things that I personally am trying to work through right now. So I will take all of that to heart, because you are very spot on. And as I continue to discover this week after week in my new Just Me with R.R. Campbell podcast, yeah, that's the understanding that I'm starting to develop for myself as a person, for myself professionally, and I'm hoping that listeners and viewers over on YouTube are starting to do the same. We'll all try and get there together. We don't need to be in a hurry, right? So very good, Gabriella. We've talked so much today. We've covered a lot of topics here, but I know that this is really just a start of what DIY MFA can really become for writers. So why don't you take a moment now to let listeners know where they can go to learn more and to start with this themselves if they would like to do so.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny you mentioned that we kind of scooted away from DIY MFA. The reason I am so passionate about this platform stuff is that we are in the middle of rebuilding our flagship platform course with the hopes of releasing it in mid-May. So fingers crossed.
Yeah,
so that's exciting. But yeah, for folks who want to get to know me, get to know DIY MFA a little bit more, what I always recommend first and foremost is hop on over to diymfa.com/join, J-O-I-N, and sign up for our newsletter. You'll get the starter kit, which is basically like it's a kit basically with DIY MFA exercises for each of the pillars, writing, reading, community. And then we also have an additional worksheet for the podcast. And we kind of give you the lay of the land over the course of a few weeks where you get these emails with the resources. So you can get to know, you'll get more of a deep dive on the building your reading list. You'll get to know a little bit more about getting those words on the page and a technique that I offer or that I recommend for that. And it'll also give you a sense for the style of what DIY MFA is all about. So you get a sense for whether you are truly a word nerd at heart. We also have a free Facebook group that's like part of our, you know, anyone who joins the newsletter, it's included in that email we send out with the resources. So if you are on Facebook, I know Facebook, a lot of people aren't into that these days. But if you are, that's where the cool kids hang out. So come and hang out with us. And yeah, I'd say like the starter kit, joining the Facebook group. And then if you are into listening to podcasts, we have a podcast. So you'll find it linked on the main DIY MFA page. But if you go to diymfa.com/listen, you'll get the entire archive because iTunes only like publishes the most recent, I think, 100 episodes, but we've got like 300 some odd episodes at this point. So yeah, you'll get the whole kip and caboodle and you can like, you could start at the beginning. I hope you don't because those are really embarrassing, but like you can start in the middle and then move your way forward. And we've got some really amazing authors who I've had on the show. So that it's a lot of fun. I think you'll enjoy it.
A lot of fantastic resources there. And I can say firsthand, I did head to diymfa.com/join a couple of weeks ago and get those newsletters. Very informative stuff. They helped me prepare for this conversation. I know we had a quick turnaround time from first contact to recording. So I was very grateful for those newsletters for that reason as well. And I'm looking forward to getting into the podcast. So Gabriella, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell Rightscast here on the Rightscast Network.
Thanks so much for having me. This was so much fun.
That's all for my interview of Gabriella Pereira of DIY MFA. For more from Gabriella, you can visit DIYMFA.com or check out her book, DIY MFA, Write with Focus, Read with Purpose, Build Your Community. Thanks to Gabriella for joining me, and thanks to you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you could leave the Rightscast Network a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. This will help the Rightscast Network reach more writers like you, and building that community is what we, and I hope you, are all about. To those of you who have already left us a rating and review, thank you. I'd also like to thank the Rightscast Network's patrons who contribute to our programming financially at patreon.com/rightscast. In exchange for their support, Rightscast Network patrons get access to some great patron perks, including Rightscast Network swag like stickers, t-shirts, and mugs. They get discounts on my editing services, and they get entries in monthly drawings for partial manuscript critiques performed by yours truly. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can join patrons like Laura Hazen and Angeline Bully today in supporting our programming directly at $1, $2, or $3 per episode or per month. Any level of contribution will get you access to some of those fantastic patron perks, so become a supporter today by making your pledge at patreon.com/rightscast. That's patreon.com/rightscast. Thanks as well to our on-air sponsors Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association. To learn more about them or our other sponsors, you can visit rightscast.net/sponsors. Coming up next on the Rightscast Network is an episode of Novel Approaches. For this one, I'm joined by author Candace Lee of the But Is It Right podcast, and we'll be discussing emotional wounds as motivation. That episode will hit Apple Podcasts, rightscast.net, and your other favorite podcast listening platforms on May 8th. Until then, you can stay in touch with us by visiting rightscast.net or by saying hello on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Rightscast, or by searching for the Rightscast Network. We're also available by email at rightscast@gmail.com, and you can now call us at area code 608-284-8342, where you can leave a voicemail with questions for future guests or other matters you'd like us to address in future programming. Again, that number is 608-284-8342. To reach me personally, you can visit rrcampbellwrites.com or holler at me on Twitter as @IamRRCampbell. I love hearing from listeners of all backgrounds, so please don't hesitate to reach out. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this is R.R. Campbell signing off. Write on and write well. This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association, and always streaming at rightscast.net.